As a general rule, he held policymakers in low regard.
"What are these pencil dicks doing?" Greg asked.
"Well, hard for us to fight when our leaders and our nation don't realize we're at war," I responded.
"They kill our people in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam, then this Millennium Plot, and they're going to kill more and we just sit here. This shitty little presidential finding about Bin Laden, what the fuck is that? We can only kill him if we're attempting to capture him? But we can't get the resources or the green light to do this ourselves, so we depend on Afghan tribesmen, but we hang all these legal and operational limits on them. Shit, most of them can't even read, and we don't control them. Even in this building, these fuckwads don't get it."
"I'm in this building."
"You and Kofor get it, the director. I'm not sure about how many others, but that doesn't mean you're not a fuckwad."
"Thanks."
"You're welcome."
"Listen, the time will come. It will be ugly, and the guys downtown will ask us to respond. We will. There will be blood in the sand." I had used that melodramatic line with CIA division chiefs during my regular briefings to them, urging them to prepare. Maybe these CIA mandarins, responsible for huge geographic chunks of the world, figured I was a warmonger or a manipulative bureaucrat. Perhaps they surmised I was seeking to build a rationale for more CTC resources and authorities, so we could do our job. Maybe I was. Yet even some smart and worldly CIA operational leaders struggled with the concept that a bunch of non-state actors based in Afghanistan, where only 6% of the people had electricity, posed a serious threat to the world's sole superpower. We were at war, but for the most part we did not realize it. We had never encountered anything like it. It was simply too different and too strange for the system to recognize, much less react in a meaningful way.
"Look, you know this better than anybody," I grumbled. "There are only a handful of officers prepared to fight AQ. The mission will fall to us. There is nobody else. But it will be difficult. Some just don't get it. For Christ's sake, the deputy director of operations wants to cut paramilitary training for new officers. He says there is no need."
"Yeah, I heard. Then there's defense. Pentagon pussies, most of them," Greg muttered. After some silence, I added, "We can't bust a gut on this. We are a great nation. We have great men and women who serve. We will have our shot. We must get ready and inform and encourage others. We can't do much more. We don't allocate resources. We don't make policy." He almost sighed, then fidgeted for a couple of seconds, and then bounced up from his chair.
"I'm going for a run," he said, and he headed for the door.
Masood. The Millennium Plot underscored the importance of understanding AQ's plans and intentions as an intelligence collection imperative. That meant penetrating their primary safe haven in Afghanistan. CTC had several productive operations around and inside Afghanistan. These operations, human and technical, included both unilateral asset networks and foreign liaison services. I needed to visit the region to meet our officers, our liaison partners, and our ally and United Front leader, Ahmed Shah Massoud. For the last 6 months, we had sent teams into Afghanistan to assist Massoud and his operatives. We were planning to expand this cooperation. In early 2000, Mike, the second in command of the CE division, and I traveled to Central Asia. We met with the liaison services, reviewing our joint counterterrorism programs. For a couple of days, we scouted the borders with Afghanistan, meeting with local security officials. I walked the banks of the Amu Darya River and peered into the enemy's safe haven of Afghanistan just a few yards away. I wanted desperately to establish a permanent CIA presence there, and I knew the best option to achieve that objective was with the United Front, with Massoud.
Mike and I needed to meet with Masood. The local CIA officer, a verbose rascal who had no business being in the clandestine service, drove Mike and me overland for many hours. Our driver was as reckless behind the wheel as he was with his operations. He was also supremely irritating, spouting a stream of bullshit hour after hour. At one point, I considered leaving him behind along a desolate stretch of road. Not easily agitated, Mike gently intervened. I told Mike he should fire the officer at the very least. Mike explained that first we needed to complete this mission. We crossed one border without incident and then boarded an ancient Yak-40 aircraft that crossed the Pamir Mountains and ferried us to Dushanbe, Tajikistan. A sad, scruffy, dirty place, surrounded by spectacular mountains draped in glistening snow, the town served as an important hub for entry into Afghanistan for the United Front and CTC. Masood was waiting to meet us at one of his safe sites. I told Mike that only he and I would go to the meeting, nobody else. Masood was an Afghan warrior, courageous, tough, and sometimes ruthless. For a decade he had denied the Soviets the Panjshir Valley, and for this heroic feat he was known as the Lion of the Panjshir. He had been part of the fractured Afghan government that rose to power after the Soviets withdrew. This government soon faltered, and a brutal civil war ensued, leading to the rise of the Taliban. Masood retreated from Kabul to his home, the Panjshir Valley, where he sought to lead the Afghan resistance against the Taliban. This would be my first, and, unbeknownst to me at the time, my only meeting with him. Down a narrow tree-lined street, our nondescript car slipped into a nondescript driveway where armed guards stepped out of the shadows and opened our car doors. Mike and I entered the modest house via a back entrance. It was dark and warm inside. We walked into a small room. There was a small stack of wood burning in the fireplace. A slightly sweet, smoky odor wafted around us. A low table was covered with shallow wooden bowls containing dried fruit and nuts, mostly almonds, as well as a teapot with a stack of small ceramic cups. Masood, tall and sinewy, with a prominently ridged nose and high cheekbones, greeted us with a warm smile and slight nod. His handshake was not firm, not soft. He moved slowly, carefully, and easily. Abdullah Abdullah, who served as the United Front's de facto foreign minister, also greeted us. So did Amrullah, who served as our translator. Masood spoke Tajik and some limited French. Mike and I passed along Director Tenet's respects. Masood inquired about Rich. We exchanged some other pleasantries. We then entered into a long discussion about the Taliban, Afghan tribal dynamics, CIA intelligence gaps, technical needs, subversion, sabotage, and politics. An astute observer of political systems, Masood asked excellent questions about U.S. foreign policy. I asked about Iran, Pakistan, and Uzbekistan. Most of all, I wanted to know the plans and intentions of AQ. Where, when, and how would they attack the United States and our interests? How could we best stop them? Sipping sweet tea and munching almonds, sitting by a warm fire while a cold rain drizzled outside, we talked for a couple of hours. Near the conclusion of our meeting, Masood inquired if he could ask me one more question. Polite and gracious in manner and tone, he asked a question hard and sharp in content. Does the U.S. government care more about stopping Al-Qaeda and killing bin Laden, or care more about the people of Afghanistan? I stared at him and clearly replied, Al-Qaeda. The answer was obvious. The CIA's mission was singular, as directed by the White House. There was no discussion about humanitarian assistance or the future of Afghanistan. There was no covert action finding that addressed broader operational issues, or a foreign policy for that matter. Massoud, of course, already understood this. He was testing me to determine if I had the gumption to speak the truth. As good leaders do, he was also teaching me a lesson, that we must do both. We must engage the irreconcilable enemy with unrelenting determination and lethal intent, while also understanding and winning the people to our cause. It was not only a justified humanitarian concern, but also a political imperative for any enduring victory. I will forever remember his response to my answer. He nodded slowly and smiled, a sad smile on his lean, lined face. About 18 months later, only 2 days before 9/11, AQ operatives posing as journalists assassinated Massoud. They detonated a bomb concealed inside their video camera. The enemy knew of Massoud.